to Voices from the Front Lines on 90.7 KPFK in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. My name is Damon Azali, and I'm here with my co-host Eric Mann, and this is the Voices from the Front Lines segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. For today's show, we will begin with a commentary by Eric Mann on the importance of both the historical and present-day revolutionary fight for civil rights. After Eric's commentary, we'll be speaking with Ben Cheney, brother of slain civil rights activist James Cheney. 2 weeks ago, as you might have remembered, that we had the honor of speaking with Carolyn Goodman, the mother of Andy Goodman, who was also killed alongside James Cheney. Today we'll be speaking with Ben about his thoughts on the murder of his brother and the recent trial that took place convicting Klansman Edgar Ray Killen for the murder. And finally, we'll be hearing from you, the listeners, and in particular, we're hoping to hear from folks who were active in the civil rights movement. So, thank you for tuning in, and here's Eric with the commentary.
Hi, and I hope Ben Cheney is listening. I've been in touch with him. Hi, everybody. This is Eric Mann. The murder of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner was probably the decisive event in so many young left-wing, progressive, black and white people's lives. The question was, where were you when Kennedy was killed, was often asked, and I know where I was. But where were you when you first heard that they were missing? And then it later on became missing, was almost immediately understood to be dead. I was working in 1964 in the summer in a settlement house in the South Bronx. I was working with young kids. And when they found out that the three civil rights workers had been missing, one of the people who was in charge of my settlement house said, you know, we know Mickey Schwerner really well in New York. Mickey was a social worker who organized other social workers to understand the seriousness of why social work was not enough. I later went on to join CORE, and it's important to understand many of you have heard of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which probably was the frontline group down in the South overall. But CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, was also the second and also very important militant, grassroots, nonviolent, direct action organization organizing in the North and the South. I was a member. I shortly after that joined CORE as a field secretary, it was called, in the Northeast. Ben and I were talking, and the Dave Dennis, who was one of my heroes who came up from the South. But obviously one of my heroes was James Cheney. I did not do enough research. I believe he might have been younger. I want to ask Ben on that. I think he died at 19, whereas Schwerner and Goodman were in their 20s. I think one of the things that's very hard to understand is I'm doing an article right now on the qualities of a good organizer, and I'm writing the section on courage, that one of the qualities of a good organizer is to be militant and have tremendous courage. So I started going through my Googles every time I thought of somebody. So I thought of Fannie Lou Hamer, the organizer for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. I had known her for years, but had not known until later that she had been badly, badly beaten by a black prison guard under the direction of a white prison screw, as we used to call them. And her back is so badly messed up that she was in pain for the rest of her life, even though she had tremendous spirit. Then, and that was in, I think, Roseburg, Mississippi. Then we had Medgar Evers, who was killed. And Medgar Evers was the head of the Mississippi NAACP. Then I did the Google back to 1955 with the killing of Emmett Till. And he, too, was killed in Mississippi, leading to Nina Simone's probably famous Mississippi Goddamn. So one of the things that is very, very hard as I work with younger people today is to understand that I was the same age as Mickey Schwerner and Andy Goodman and James Cheney when they were killed. When we heard that they were killed, a group of people were being trained at Kent State University in Oxford, Ohio. And they were being asked, do you want to go down to Mississippi? Well, they were all very excited about it. But then when they heard about the disappearance and murder of the three civil rights workers, a lot of them had second thoughts. I read in one history that a young white kid, very well-meaning, came all the way down to Mississippi. Their first day, they walked into some kind of a country store or a bar or something like that, and they saw the white redneck crackers there. They got so much hatred just visually from that crowd, as if to say, we're going to kill you too, that this kid literally both urinated and defecated in his pants, had a nervous breakdown, and begged the Corps or COFO leaders to take him back home, home being the North, and as I said, home to being white. And so imagine at the middle of the night, a black civil rights leader from Mississippi, who's lived his whole life in Mississippi, has to drive the white kid home to at least get him out of the North because this kid is having a nervous breakdown. He could not handle for 3 hours what black people in Mississippi had handled for their whole life. One of the things that's very painful today, and Ben and I were talking about this, is for all the people that went down to Mississippi and were frightened because of what happened to James Chaney and Vicki Shortner and Andy Goodman, hundreds and hundreds went because of that. And not just in spite of that, but because of that. They made a commitment to flood Mississippi with civil rights volunteers to avenge the death of the three civil rights workers. It's very hard today, when I've been working with a tremendous number of young people who are overall terrific, for me to see the way that they are not as committed, frankly, as the people that were committed during the 60s. That they are really hardworking, they're great young people, they're militant, they want to fight, they work very long hours, they're willing to fight the police. But they don't have a perception of their own privilege. They don't understand that fundamentally at this point in history, our work is based on privilege, not based on oppression. And it's not based on the literal fear of physical beating and death, not just once in a lifetime, but every single day you go out on the block, you don't know if you're going to come back alive. In fact, the murdering of Goatee, which was the nickname for Vicki Shortner, and the murdering of Chaney, was clearly to say to other people, are you sure you want to join this movement? So on our show, Voices from the Frontlines, I'm here with my brother Damon Ozzerly, who is one of the younger, more committed, absolutely dedicated, militant, I mean, all the right things, people, part of a generation of all the good kids, if he's a little old to be a kid, but of all the good young people, and yet, it's like trying to explain the Holocaust. How do you explain the Holocaust to someone who was not there? How do you explain what we understood? I'm looking finally, and Damon does terrific research and tries to help me, and you have this picture here of Deputy Sheriff Price and Sheriff Rainey at their arraignment. They're eating popcorn or chewing tobacco. They're both laughing like, who's kidding who? I'm going to get, this whole thing is a big joke, defiant racist rednecks. Edgar Ray Killen, Wayne Roberts, Sam Bowers, murder after murder of other people as well. So I guess I want to start by saying that I am listening to you, Ben, on the TV and radio about 2 weeks ago when the trial results were announced. It was very moving to see Rita Bender, formerly Rita Shorner, Mickey's, former wife, and yourself, Ben Chaney, who's James Chaney's brother, and Carolyn Goodman, Andy Goodman's mom, to see, frankly, the continuity of politics between what I knew in 1964 and what I heard today, and frankly, your militancy, your critique of the trial, it's not like I'm looking for nostalgia. It's not like I want to say, gee, you sounded like 1964, which you did. But more, you sounded like 1964 and 2005, which is very, very hard to get these days. So, Ben Chaney, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And maybe I would like to begin by a very simple thing that gets missed is, tell us about James. Tell us, what was he like? What were you like as brothers? What do you remember about him? What do you remember about him in his last year?
Well, I don't think I can nail down a memory to one particular year. It's been 40 years. But I do know that my brother was just like anybody else when he was growing up. He used to hang out with his friends. He was asthmatic, but he was captain of the track and football team. He was very athletic, and he was an organizer. He was an organizer early on. In fact, he was suspended from high school for organizing a youth division of the NAACP in the school. So he was an organizer early on. So, and, you know, he was a good brother. I think he was a good brother.
And how old was he when he died?
He was 21.
21.
He had just turned 21 a month earlier.
And were you also living in Mississippi at the time, Ben?
Right. We were all living in Meridian, Mississippi, which is about 45 minutes away from Philadelphia.
Right. Now, tell us a little bit about CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. I joined CORE. What made James join CORE? Why did he make that choice?
Well, he was recruited. He was recruited by Matt Suarez from Louisiana and Dave Dennis.
Oh, really?
From New Orleans. They were. Dave was the CORE director for the southeastern and southern part of Mississippi, and Matt Suarez was a field coordinator for CORE. And they came over, and a group of people met Matt in his hotel room, and they talked, a group of young kids. They talked to him, and Matt told him to come back the next morning at 7 a.m. And all of them left, and the next morning, Master Red says, there was one knock on the door, and that was my brother.
That's the way it was, and that's still the way it is.
Yep.
But that's wonderful. The next thing is that when you and I were talking previously, the question of trying to bring this case to trial has been a life's work. Is that right? I mean, trying to figure out how to get a conviction in this case. I know there were several trials, several acquittals. Tell us the next stage of how long has it taken to get the particular trial of bringing Killen, a terrible name, to trial. How did this come about?
Well, Killen was tried primarily. He was used. Killen was used to avoid getting after the rich and powerful. Okay, for I guess from 1989. We've been applying pressure on the state of Mississippi, particularly in Neshoba County and Philadelphia, Mississippi, for justice. In 1989, we did our first freedom ride, reverse freedom ride from Mississippi to New York with young people. And at that time, because it was the 25th anniversary of the death, the national media was there. Then Secretary of State Dick Mopus, the Secretary of State of Mississippi, apologized for the murders. We got the state attorney general to agree to at least consider opening the cases. At that time, the state attorney general was Mike Moore, but he refused to prosecute, even though he had received several reports from his assistants that recommended he prosecute. Then in 1994, we did the same thing. We kept applying pressure up until 1994, but we had another major freedom ride, and that was the 30th anniversary. The Mississippi organizers, those veterans from the Civil Rights Movement, also had their reunion in Mississippi. That applied more pressure. And we continued to organize until 1999. We had a freedom ride, but we were at the point where we got, in 2003, we had started a national committee called the Chain of Goodman Sworn and Justice Coalition. The objective was to, during this event, during the 40th anniversary, to apply enough pressure through the Congress and the Justice Department to get the state of Mississippi to move. We had gotten Congressman Benny Thompson and Congressman John Lewis to submit a bill before the House ordering the Justice Department to investigate this case and sending the then Attorney General, I think John Ashcroft, a letter saying that he should report right back to them. The bill was introduced the day Reagan died and was like the second day of our freedom ride. The day Reagan died, the bill was introduced, so a vote was never taken on the bill. This gave the people in Mississippi a chance, then, knowing that there was going to be national pressure during this 40th anniversary, to give us somebody that they feel would quiet or at least appease this call for justice. And they gave us the most vicious. He is vicious. He's a vicious old man. He's an unrepentant racist, and he really believes that he's doing the work of God. They gave us him. You know, and he's also the poorest Klansman. But yet and still, they refuse to go after two very powerful. There's seven other guys that were involved in this murder that are still walking around.
Can you give their names? We're on
the... This was the most powerful man.
Once again, this is Ben Chaney, the brother of James Chaney on KPFK 90.7 FM, Voices from the Front Lines. Go ahead, Ben.
The most powerful one is Olin Burridge. The bodies was found on his land. He supplied the gasoline to destroy the car. He made arrangements for the bodies to be buried, the bulldozer and the personnel that did that. Plus, for the past 40 years, he has been supporting some of these poor guys himself financially. Okay, this guy, he owns one of the largest construction companies in the South. He's the owner of that Yates Construction. He's a multimillionaire. And he started his career off on killing black folks. Okay? And then there was another guy who was involved in the case that the Justice Department dropped charges on was, his name is Tommy Horns. Tommy Horns became a member of the Mississippi State Legislature, and for several years he served on the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission. Now, the Attorney General, Mike Moore, back in 89 and 94 was telling us that he was going to prosecute this case, Tommy Horns was using his influence and power to keep the case from going nowhere. So there's some very rich and powerful people that the state attorney general has so far refused to go after, and he's still saying that he's not going to go after these guys.
And Ben, I have a quick question, because I know this is Damon Azalea, the other co-host. In 1967, there were, from what I'm doing research, there were people who were actually convicted, and there were people who there was no...
Right, that was a federal trial. That was violating their civil rights.
It was not for murder.
Not for murder. It was a federal trial. See, because the murders occurred in the state on state property, the feds had no grounds for prosecuting for murder. They could not prosecute for murder. My understanding is they could only prosecute for violating their civil rights. Had circumstances like the bodies been found on a reservation or a federal weapon was used, perhaps so. I don't know. But I do know that was not the state of Mississippi for 40 years has refused to prosecute these people, you know. First, in 1964, the DA in Philadelphia, Mississippi, was saying that they were not American citizens, you know, that the three victims were not U.S. citizens. Allegedly, they couldn't be proved to be U.S. citizens. So we don't prosecute. You know, that was one of the excuses they gave. But the state of Mississippi has refused for 40 years to prosecute these guys.
Well, one of the things, I mean, obviously, you have a view that there's a tri-racial committee that was in some way pushing for the prosecution of, as you say, the sort of single gunman, you know, back to Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, trying to reduce it to one person, as a way to try to clean up Mississippi's image. Why don't you address that?
Absolutely.
Why don't you tell us about that story?
Absolutely. There's once our resolution was not able to be passed, wasn't voted on, the locals in Philadelphia, Mississippi, started the local business people are white because there's no black businesses in that city. There's only no major black businesses, and there's only one or two in the downtown area. So these white gentlemen. And some of them who have their granddaddies and daddies were associated either with the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council, formed an organization called the Philadelphia Coalition. It started out as the Philadelphia Task Force. And they were going to work with us to put on a major event for the 40th anniversary. But they had two goals. The first goal was to change the image of Neshoba County and Philadelphia. They went before the Board of Supervisors to get funding for their project. And as reported in the Neshoba County Democrat, which is a local newspaper there, the black leader of the young black leader of the NAACP who joined this coalition told the Board of Supervisors they were not there to prosecute anyone. They wanted to change the image of people that people have about Mississippi, in particular Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Neshoba County. And he went further to say that that was taking place because they had formed this organization of biracial or triracial, consisting of Native Americans, whites, and blacks. And that triracial organization was presenting a different image or what the people coming into the state calling for justice was presenting. And that was their first goal, the main goal. The other goal was to lure, to rewrite the history of the civil rights movement in Shelby County. Let me give you an example. The executive director for the group, former Governor William Winters, has an organization in Mississippi, and it's called the William Winters Institute. The former director, the present director of that group, in helping the Philadelphia Coalition get organized, sent out an email saying that Cecil Price's name should not be spoken of or should not be used as being involved in this incident. The reason why? Because he had his son and his grandson still lived in the area. Now listen, had not Cecil Price stopped the station wagon first time, took him to jail, charged my brother with allegedly with speeding, charged Andrew Goodman and Michael Swann with attempting to burn down a black church, which they used to lure these guys back to Neshoba County, had not ceased, and then held them in jail until 10 p.m., released them, and then stopped them again, hit my brother in the head with a flashlight, and turned them over to be murdered. Had not he did those acts, they probably would be alive now. So, but they decide they need to write Cecil Price, Deputy Cecil Price's name out of the history of that particular, out of that incident. And that was that's their two main objectives. You know, they call themselves a racial reconciliation group. And the idea is to change the history of the civil rights movement, to whitewash this history, to make it less aggressive, to make it less black. You know, because after all, you look in the movie Mississippi Burning, you know, the FBI came down there to do what? To protect the civil rights workers, and they did. So their objective is to whitewash the history of the civil rights movement.
So you're listening to 90.7 KPFK, and we're on the phone with Ben Chaney, who's the brother of James Chaney, who was killed by the KKK back in 1964. So, Ben, I was doing a lot of research today about the actual event. I knew the names. I knew that they were killed, but that was pretty much it because there's not so much beyond that. So one of the things that I thought was interesting was that they were actually on their way to a church called Mount Zion Church, which a week before, the same people, the KKK, actually burned down. And this was after, I think, 4 or 5 months in which they were actually had a kind of like a hit out on Schwerner, who was the first white organizer in Mississippi. And so they thought Schwerner was actually going to be at this church the night they showed up. He was actually with your brother up north doing a training to recruit more folks come down. They ended up burning the church. And a week later, that's when your brother, Goodman and Schwerner came down to get witnesses about the church burning. So I just thought that was really just interesting how, you know, it wasn't just kind of a single, it was a very, very thought out, planned out thing.
Let me explain, okay. Let me clarify a few things. Back in April, I think, right after winter was ending, spring was early, my brother went into Neshoba County and he convinced the deacons and the reverend, the minister of the church, to let Mickey come and speak to him because it was a black church out in Lawndale, Mississippi. So he convinced them to let him come and speak to the congregation. So my brother and Mickey went to the church one Sunday, met with the congregation, and they agreed to use the church as a freedom school. Where blacks was taught how to register and vote, you know. So as the people in the community found out, the whites in the community found out that the church was going to be used as that, and they attacked the church, they burnt the church down, they beat some of the old folks, and then when Mickey and my brother James heard word of this, they were in Oxford, Ohio. They came back to try to convince these people in the community to file federal civil rights complaints against the sheriff and against the deputy Cecil Price and others in that community to try to get some type of major investigation going on, and that was the destruction of the church was the trap. It was the bait to lure Mickey and James and Andy back there so they could kill them. The conspiracy started against Mickey and Rita, I think, back in January when they first came into Meridian, Mississippi.
Right.
They were the first whites in that particular part of Mississippi. There were other whites in other parts of Mississippi from early on that had been there prior to them coming down. But that once they got there, you know, they have Mississippi in the 50s, mid-50s organized a group called the Sovereignty Commission. It was an official state agency. The agency's objective was to prevent integration, okay, to do anything possible to prevent integration. That was spying on civil rights workers. That was setting up framing civil rights workers. So they had a network of spies across and informants throughout the whole state. In fact, the Sovereign Commission had a black informant at the meeting in Oxford, Ohio, where James and Andy and other people talked about the destruction of Mount Zion, and they made their plans to come back to Mississippi. That informant, that black informant, called the Sovereign Commission up and told the Sovereign Commission that the car they was driving, how many people were in the car, and the route that they were traveling. Once the Sovereign Commission got that information, then they gave that information along to the local sheriff. And who happens to be the local sheriff? Lawrence Rainey.
Well, you know, what you're trying to convey, and I want to move this a little bit, Ben, now to the present, is it's hard to understand when you go into a community that a simple thing, you know, we talk about the SNCC Freedom Schools, which are amazing, or the Core Freedom Schools, but imagine that you are going to a pastor who is absolutely petrified that this could be Emmett Till, or this could be James Chaney, or this could be, you know, Medgar Evers. You're asking them to have a freedom school with black and white people talking about the right to vote. There are black informants. There are black sharecroppers who are petrified working for white owners, like in the Emmett Till situation. One poor black guy had to put that 75-pound weight around Emmett Till's neck to throw it into the water. You have the police, who are totally on the side of the Ku Klux Klan, as we used to say, you know.
Who are in the Ku Klux Klan.
Right, who are in the Ku Klux Klan. We used to say, blue by day, white by night, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely.
Then you got the federal government, the Kennedys, at the time. But who were the Kennedys in with? The Kennedys are in with all the Southern Democrats who were powerful. So the Kennedys are in with Eastland and Stennis. And Russell, all these right-wing senators, I mean, not right-wing, Klansmen U.S. senators, who, because of the seniority system, have been there for 25, 30, and 40 years and control all these armed service committees and stuff like that. So that's what I started the show by saying, that the very fight for the vote took a revolution to get the vote. It didn't take a reform to get the vote. It took a revolution to get the vote. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. The fight for the vote was a real revolution. In fact, in his book, Three Lives in Mississippi, I think Huey describes a trip that my brother took into Neshoba County. And once he had talked to him, just to get word whether or not they were going to let him and Mickey speak at the church. And someone else with him, I don't remember the name now, but Huey describes the scene as once they got into crossing the Neshoba County line, my brother was driving, he turned the headlights off of the car. There was no lights, and he just started going 80, 90 miles an hour on dirt roads and those backwooded areas where there's sharp turns. And the passenger who was with him said he didn't even see those turns. He don't know how my brother saw the turns. He said, suddenly, my brother pulled into this vacant lot and pulled into a driveway, but he didn't know it was a driveway and turned off the lights. He got out and he whistled, and then you could see a crack in a door. You could see the light coming through a crack in the door. Someone whistled back, and they walked into this door where there was a lamp in the middle of the floor. The windows was covered, you know, and the doors was closed. No light was coming out. And the gentleman who was with my brother gave the lady of the house some leaflets on voter registration. And he describes it as saying that she took him and hit him as if, and handled him like she was handling TNT. And she hit him, put him up under the mattress, between the mattress and the bed. And then it seems like, as the gentleman describes, they spent a lot of time, the locals, trying to tell my brother the best roads to travel. and how to get out of there, you know, how to avoid the sheriff and his deputy. And he said that once they left, again, my brother was driving 89 miles an hour on those dirt roads with no lights, no nothing from the sky, and till he get to the Lauderdale County line, which is where we live, Meridian, and then he would turn on the headlights and slow down.
Wow. Tell us, you have a few more minutes. We want to keep you as long as we can, Ben. We're with Ben Chaney, the brother of James Chaney, the famous civil rights leader. We're here trying to celebrate the victory and the conviction of manslaughter in this case, but we're also trying to talk about, frankly, the limits of the law, the limits of the present situation. Tell us a little bit about the black community in Philadelphia, Mississippi, around the trial. Your efforts to, you know, make this into a showcase trial. I know that you had journalists probably from Germany, I bet you France, England, Spain, South Africa, but how many black people could you get out from Philadelphia?
Well, I mean, first of all, it wasn't my efforts to make it a showcase trial. It was their efforts, and they did a pretty good job.
Very interesting. Okay.
The only people who, the only black folks initially who was at that trial were people from the community, were those who I know personally. And that's only a small number of people. Then other black people, and my family, of course, my family was there from different parts of the country. Then other blacks from seeing the empty seats in the courtroom on television came from Louisiana, from Arkansas, from Georgia, from Alabama, you know, and Florida. They just got in their cars, they just drove over here. One told me just to fill up the seat. It was important that the seat be full. So you know, one of the issues that I had with the Philadelphia Coalition and with the leadership, African American leadership, and I've talked about this openly and freely because it needs to be discussed, is where is the leadership? What happened to the leadership? It seems to me that these three guys, James, Andy, and Mickey, came back to this community after those folks was beaten and the church was burned down and those old senior citizens was beaten. They came back to this community to help that community. And I couldn't understand how come the people in that community could not show up and exercise their voice just by sitting in the courtroom. I feel like that the line to get into the courtroom should have been around the corner, and it should have been primarily African Americans from that community. But I was talking to a young lady the other day from Philadelphia. We were talking over the phone, and she told me simply that nobody told the people in Philadelphia it was okay to attend the trial. It was okay to attend the trial. And I'm looking at the leadership now. You know, what is the leadership doing? How come the leadership isn't making sure that the community is exercising their voice, individually or collectively? So, and how come the leadership is not pushing for more economic equality, particularly in downtown Philadelphia, Mississippi, other than just having two or three small black businesses? There are no major black businesses in the town or in the county. And I'm pretty sure the only businesses they have are like mom-and-pop stores. That's in the black community. They have undertakers and funeral homes and barbershops and of course, beauty parlors. In the downtown area, they only have a beauty parlor, black beauty parlor. So now there are no black businesses there. There's no economical growth in the black community. And it seems to me that there's a serious void in leadership, serious leadership that's going to speak on behalf of the local African-American community in Philadelphia. And as a result, we're putting on August 2nd, we're going to be hosting a town meeting in a church. We got permission of a minister to use his church. In Philadelphia, Mississippi, where we're going to talk about the lack of leadership and what does the community do now? What exactly is the problem? How come the community is not exercising their voice? This is 40 years, you know. How come you guys ain't talking, ain't running your mouths, ain't speaking up? And then what should the community be doing concerning the economical problems that they're facing?
Well, that's terrific. And, I mean, obviously, we know that there's a phenomenal... I mean, sometimes, Ben, you want to try to say it as if you understand it, but it defies explanation. We have 2 million people in jail, 1.2 million are black and Latino. We have elected officials in the state legislature, black and Latino, carrying bills, some of the most reactionary bills for corporate polluters. We have a civil rights case going on in L.A. We can't get virtually any elected officials to support a very successful civil rights case. There's a crisis in the black community. There's a crisis in the Latino community, in the Asian community. There's a crisis in the white so-called radical community. You know, you wonder, I'm writing a book called Revolutionary Organizing in the Age of Reaction, and it feels like it's 1952 or something, you know. It feels like, so I think that the work you're doing on August 2nd, if people want to get involved, if people want to even especially try to get people they know in the South to go, how do they contact you?
They can reach me by email. You can log on to our website, jecf.org, and there should be a way to click on to my email, or you can email me directly at benchaney@aol.com.
You got one of the best ones, benchaney@aol.com.
Yeah.
And what does the JCEF stand for?
James Earl Cheney Foundation.
Okay.
Now, let me say something.
Sure, please.
The thing on August 2nd is James and Mickey were grassroots organizers, all right? They dealt with the people on a grassroots level. We're not necessarily asking people from outside of Philadelphia to attend this event.
Okay.
This is a confrontation between those who live there and why they are not doing nothing. This is what this is about.
Okay, good.
Now, future events. But we first, you know, we got to shake the tree and let all the nuts fall out so that, we, you know, the tree can grow big and strong. You understand what I'm saying?
Of course.
That's the logic, you know. We got to confront the community and see what's wrong. Because there's some talented young people there. There's some talented people there. They're just not speaking up.
Well, first of all, we want our listeners to call on 818-985-5735 who would like to discuss the state of the present civil rights movement and the lessons from Ben Cheney's remarks. Ben, any chance I can get you to stay on for a few more minutes?
I'm afraid not. I got people waiting on me now.
Okay. Well, listen, you stayed right to your time limit. This is Eric Mann and Damon Osley. You're on with Ben Cheney, one of our very best guests. We're going to get you back, Ben.
Okay.
And you can reach him at benchaney@aol.com. And let us know. I'd like to have you come back on the show afterwards to tell us about what happened down in Philadelphia, Mississippi. I just want to end by saying that you really do convey, if I may say, the militancy, the clarity of purpose, the intellect, the spirit of the civil rights revolution of the 1960s brought into the year 2000, as I say, not just with nostalgia, but with a lot of energy and enthusiasm. So thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to take a Don't go away. We're gonna have a short break. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. When we come back, call us on 818-985-5735 or else Damon and I are going to do doo-wop for 20 minutes.